Good morning.
Good morning.
Good friends. I come here early at 6 o'clock and sit zazen with a few good friends. We have a breakfast that Rachel or one of the other of our good friends prepared. And then lots more good friends come in to join us. And I've just been thinking often lately how grateful I am for this community, clouds and water, and all that makes it possible. This week, in our leadership team meeting, our administrative director, Will Hageman, gave us a little report. Financial report. And I decided I want to pass on a little bit of that to you this morning, because it's things we should all be aware of and take some responsibility for it. For this year so far, our program income, that is fees for classes, donations for classes, and that sort of thing, is a little bit ahead of projections that our budget is based on. Income from donations from friends, that is people who are not members, is a little bit above projections. But member donations is way, way below projections on which our budget is based. So I just wanted to, I thought this kind of information we ought to share as a community once in a while. So I put that out there as a sort of word to the wise. We need to support the Sangha, and it takes resources for us to be alive and have such a fine space as we do to practice in. We have a practice period coming up very soon. April 3rd it begins. And we'll talk about that a little bit later this morning. The theme of our practice period is true happiness. So what's that? What's true happiness? Let me ask you, we could start out with a little bit of dialogue. How would you define true happiness, or what is untrue happiness? Anybody have a contribution? Yes, Peter.
The bird that was serenading us through the meditation time, it seems to fall right upon what I would describe as true happiness. In the moment, pure joy expressed.
So you're hearing some joy in what's happening that has some relationship to spring? The natural world, in any case. Leonard?
Being grateful for what I have.
Being grateful for what I have. Yes?
True happiness is something that you fostered from yourself. It's not something that external things or people can give you. It's something that has to grow from within.
Something, I didn't hear you very well.
Oh,
could you repeat the last?
It's something that has to grow from within. I think it's not something that can be contingent upon your circumstances or external things in your world. I think it's something that you have to decide for yourself and foster happiness for yourself.
Thank you. So something that grows from within, not so dependent on external things. Felt pretty good to get up and go outside this morning, didn't it? Yeah, pretty good. Spring. And we ought to be happy with that. But it's not going to last, is it?
Thanks a lot.
Not forever.
Life as it is.
So I'm a Vikings fan, maybe. I'm not, but some people are. Totally dedicated. And what? How do we feel when the team wins big? Pretty good, huh? We're happy. But sooner or later, a game is lost. Donations to Clouds and Water are exceeding expectations. I'm pretty happy. Oh, they're down this year. Not happy. So as I see it, you pointed right to it. I think true happiness is not vulnerable to the ups and downs of everyday conditions. And I think a happiness that's not vulnerable to, easily vulnerable to change in conditions is a mature happiness, or happiness that's based on a mature outlook in our life. The great teacher Sawaki Roshi once said, "This practice is simply about being an adult." So I want to talk this morning about one important way in our tradition of talking about the path of maturity. And what I want to talk about is has as its basis Yogacara philosophy. Yogacara is to some extent a school of Buddhism. It still exists at least as the headquarters temple and institution in Nara, Japan. But Yogacarans were extremely analytical. They identified all the dharmas that we can think of, all the aspects of reality and so forth. What has had the most influence on Buddhist thinking generally and on our tradition is the Yogacaran's careful study of human consciousness. What is it that creates what we are aware of, what our consciousness holds? The Yogacarans identified 8 consciousnesses. The 6 sense consciousnesses: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, taste or tongue consciousness, and body or touch consciousness. All those are avenues to perception, create the reality that's in our mind. The 7th one is called manas consciousness. And this is the self-referential consciousness, that consciousness that sees everything somehow in relation to me or I, my likes and dislikes and that sort of thing. It's our ego-centered consciousness. But underneath all of these is the base consciousness, or the alaya vijnana, which is usually translated storehouse consciousness. It's also called the treasure consciousness. This is the consciousness created by all of our conscious experience, everything we have ever done, everything we have ever thought. And when we understand interbeing or interdependence, we know that everything we have ever seen or thought really includes everything the human race has ever seen or thought or been conscious of, done. So this is a huge, vast storehouse, a repository of human experience that's behind our consciousness, our perceptive mechanisms. The storehouse consciousness is also called seed consciousness. There's something in there in the Sanskrit that translates pretty directly, I think, as seed. Katagiri Roshi, our founding abbot here in Minnesota, said, well, it's not like an avocado seed, not seed in that sense. But Thich Nhat Hanh, on the other hand, uses the seed metaphor quite directly, and we'll talk about that. So I think that this seed consciousness is like a seed, the energy that comes forth from the present and generates the next instant. The energy coming forth from everything, earth, form of tree, water, ocean, asphalt, highways. Now, don't be frightened off by this, but here's a paragraph from Katagiri Roshi. According to this philosophy, the basic consciousness of Alaya Vijnana becomes mature in the unconscious world, appears as form and function of the conscious world, then disappears and returns with a perfume that makes it mature in the unconscious world. Then it appears again as a new world of form and function. You got that? The basic consciousness becomes mature in the unconscious world. This is simply that realm of all experience, which we cannot be conscious of. When we respond to anything, perceive anything, we don't think through all the components of that perception. This comes out of all our experience and human experience. So it becomes mature in the unconscious world. Then it appears as form, form of tree, form of Zen practice, form of Zen center, form of me, form of you. All of these come out of this repository that is unconscious. Then it says, he says, disappears and returns with a perfume. Based on this unconscious world, we have perceptions. On those perceptions, we think and we act. And so the unconscious world is influenced in turn. Perfumed is the verb he used here, by our action. Disappears and returns with a perfume that makes it mature in the unconscious world. Then it appears again. It's out of that same storehouse that we will act and we will think. It appears again as a new world of form and function. And I'm going to look at the way some of the language that has been put to this in a few different cases. It is said that this energy operates in three steps. One, seed produces seed. So this is that energy coming forth from the unconsciousness. Secondly, seed produces form. This perception gives us notions of family, tree, friend, anything, manifestations of that seed, and form, step three, perfumes seed. Every little thing that we do leaves an imprint on this basic consciousness. This is the important point for us to understand. Sometimes I find myself with a lazy mind. Ooh, how often. But sometimes a lazy mind that is rather enjoying unhealthy patterns of thought. desire. Every time I pass that billboard on Interstate 94 that announces the current size of the Powerball pot, a certain mind of desire comes up. But a lazy mind enjoying negative patterns of thought, unhealthy thought, it seems to me, we usually feel, I think, I usually do, it doesn't matter. I mean, this is just my mind playing around, right? Not having any effect on me or the world. But in fact, the understanding that the Yogacarans helped us with is that every thought and every action perfumes those seeds, makes a difference in the unconscious world out of which our subsequent actions and thoughts arise. What that means to me is, in other words, there is nothing that doesn't matter. And our task is awareness, to see, to begin to perceive, understand our own consciousness, to be with it, at a level at which we can see in a very subtle way what arises and see our reaction to it. To see the kind of perfume that we are giving to what arises. We go about our business in the everyday world of our lives. But the deep unconscious behind our actions is itself transformed by every thought, every action of our conscious life. This transformation, I think, is what our practice is all about. Our thoughts and actions shape our storehouse consciousness, and that perfumed consciousness authors our subsequent thoughts and actions. Thich Nhat Hanh, as I mentioned, uses the seed metaphor directly. The content of the storehouse consciousness we can think of as so many seeds. And the question in Thich Nhat Hanh's mind is, which seeds are we going to water? Which seeds are we going to flourish because of our choices? Which seeds will perfume our continually maturing storehouse consciousness? And an understanding of the Yogacara view of consciousness is not complete without a clear recognition of interbeing, of our utter interdependence. It's not something where we can go off on our own with a driven consciousness to plant good seeds. It can only happen with our action and our thought clearly aware of our interdependence with all beings. Another quote from Katagiri Roshi. Sit in Zazen. Calm your six sense consciousnesses, and then quiet the egoistic manas consciousness. At that time, basic consciousness touches all things without exception, the whole universe. This is alaya vijnana, the serene and tranquil state of consciousness that is the original nature of human life. This mind of tranquility is called Bodhi mind, universal consciousness, or the Buddha way. Sit in Zazen, calm your sixth sense consciousness, and then quiet the egoistic manas consciousness. Then we can begin to understand. And I really enjoy the simple way that it is put in Red Pine's translation of the Platform Sutra. The sutra says this whole earth body, our body and by extension all that this body is a myriad-fold transformation body constantly transforming itself. If we plant seeds of malice, a mind of evil, or I would say a mind of self-centered thoughts, this turns us into beasts. Compassion turns us into bodhisattvas. This myriad-fold transformation body is three bodies in the Platform Sutra's outline. The Dharma body, which is our body exactly as it is, our body in its wholeness, which is the whole universe, as the true human body, as Sosan talked about last week. That's the Dharman body, just as it is, before we poke our heads into it. The transformation body, which, he says, is our thoughts, what goes on in our mind. The realization body, he says, is when your next thought is always good. Kategori Roshi probably would say when your next thought comes from a high perspective, a perspective of interdependence rather than the small outlook of our likes and dislikes or what's in it for me. The body at peace, I think, is the body that never forgets its interdependence. And there, perhaps, is the body of true happiness. Kategori Roshi again. Your life is maturing from moment to moment. You cannot stop it. But you can manifest that maturity through your form. Your form is your everyday life. In order to manifest maturity in your life, you need form, because without form, you would never have a chance to make yourself mature. Then the form of your everyday life is an indication of your maturity. Consistently planting seeds of beneficial actions, seeds of loving kindness, requires extraordinary attentiveness to what is really going on. And that extraordinary attentiveness we call mindfulness. Kategori Roshi again. The universal path is complete tranquility and at the same time constantly flowing. It exists forever, constantly supporting all beings. But to make it something that is alive in your life, you have to do something. You have to touch it directly with full awareness and turn it into reality. Through practice, you become one with Alayavijñāna and experience the stillness of the original nature of existence. Then, time matures, the storehouse consciousness works dynamically, and the human form called Buddha or Bodhisattva appears in the world. And this is exactly, I think, what our practice is about. Now, our self-centered habits are very deeply ingrained. We will not overcome them by waking up in the morning with a determined mind not to be self-centered. We need some help. To get beyond them and learn to water the good seeds of our deepest consciousness consistently in our actions requires a strong commitment, and it requires a group of good friends. So that brings us to our practice here at Clouds and Water and the practice period, which will begin before very long. There are many ways in which we help each other with this path here at Clouds and Water. Monthly sessions, meditation retreats, gatherings on Sunday morning, classes, opportunities for study. Social times when we can enjoy being together with good friends. Practice period is one of the most important. Practice period is a kind of derivative from the monastic practice in our background. It took its present form partly with some of the pioneers from Japan, Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, in their search for ways to make their kind of practice available to Westerners who seem to like to have families and jobs and probably aren't in the monastery. So our practice period is, we're very generous. What we encourage from each other is a level of commitment for a period of time. And I think this practice period coming up is 6 weeks. For 6 weeks, some significant level of commitment beyond what we ordinarily do. Maybe it's sitting Zazen early in the morning 3 times a week here with the community. Maybe it's doing that once a week here. Maybe it's a commitment to sitting 2 times a week, or we would like to see some kind of sitting daily at home. And maybe it includes a commitment to being here at each Sunday morning gathering. Maybe it includes participation in a class. Let's see, are we including the class in basically what it makes you a member of the practice period? I'm not sure.
I doubt it.
I don't think so, no. Class, if you can work it and it is what you are interested in, a class. One of the classes underway is a We used to make that kind of the central part of the practice period, but we're a little more flexible at this point. So let's see, I think I have a list. Zazen with the community. And I really strongly recommend that some of your Zazen time be with the community, however it can be. I sat for myself for a year when I began this practice, by myself. And it doesn't work very well that way. A service of bowing and chanting here at the center. Zazen at home. A little ceremony on waking up in the morning. A bow. A verse. A little ceremony before we retire. These things help us to keep our intention clearly in mind. They help us to water the seeds that we want to water. Family ceremony, meetings with a practice leader. One of the things that I emphasize when I give some instruction to newcomers to the meditation path is that I hope they will make a commitment to something on a regular basis. I think you all know that when we say, I have an intention to sit on Thursday morning, that sounds like it would be a good idea. I'll do that when I can. Doesn't quite get us there. Thursday morning comes and there's usually something more attractive. And I tell people that when you find yourself sitting Zazen, when sitting Zazen is the last thing you want to do, then you have begin to know what making a commitment is about. So that's something I strongly recommend in going into practice period, that you be clear about commitments with yourself. It doesn't matter, you're not always going to meet them, likely. But we do our very best, and just having a commitment really helps us. Give ourselves wholeheartedly to the schedule that we've set or the schedule of the community. I suspect that true happiness, as we've identified, is not vulnerable to the ups and downs of each day's joys and disappointments. I suspect that true happiness requires mindfulness, presence, and calm. I suspect that true happiness requires generosity. Every action undertaken for the benefit of all beings. I think these are other ways of saying that true happiness requires a continual watering of the good seeds in our storehouse consciousness. So, practically speaking, I might not be armed with all the practicalities as I should, but there is a flyer about practice period out in the entryway, and do we have forms for people to fill out available for joining the practice period?
I'm sure they're online.
Okay. Online you will find a place to register for the practice period, but please look into that soon. If it's a possibility for you, if it interests you. So for the rest of our lives, we will never be without an opportunity for mindfulness or generosity. And I think this group of good friends, a cl- clouds and water exists only to help us with that path. So we have a little bit of time. We have quite a bit of time. And let's have a little dialogue. What comes up for you? Questions. And these could be questions about practice period or questions about the Alaya Vijnana or anything we said. Or comments, Anne.
Yeah, I would describe myself on a pathway to tranquility and compassion. And I'm in the process of really renovating still. I've been renovating for a number of years, but really renovating my relationship, in particular to my teenager, and having a bigger container for compassion, mm-hmm. for behavior that I judge, but not becoming self-righteous. And what I'm noticing more and more is how we use the parts of ourselves that are greedy, aversive, all these parts of ourselves that we judge as unwholesome or ugly, we actually stand on them in the maturation or wisdom piece. And so it's really a mistake to point at those parts of ourselves that are failing, that aren't in alignment with that, because those are the parts that actually, I think, we return, that return you talk about, to me, that has to do with the seed has to go into the earth and embody something to come back as a mature piece. And I'll give one specific example of this, is I work in hospice. And I'm, as a person, I like a lot of intimacy, and I'm kind of greedy. I like touch, and these are the exact pieces that have been greedy in my youth, and in my adulthood, they have given rise to extreme generosity, because those are the pieces I use to invite people to walk with me as they die, or to be held in a space. So I what I like about this practice is, and it's hard to remember, because when you say every moment counts, well, every moment counts. But forgiving the moments that aren't wholesome is actually more important than getting rid of everything ugly, in my experience. That was long-winded.
Very well said. Thank you. Yes, thank you. That's very well said, and I agree with you. And I was looking for, there was something there in Red Pines in the Platform Sutra that you reminded me of. Well, when the next thought is good, when every thought is good, and I don't think that means that every thought is about something happy or positive we like in our life, but it is holding that thought, those thoughts, in a good way. I spent yesterday in a workshop on what's called at St. Paul's Monastery on biospiritual focusing. It's the work of focusing. It is the work of learning to hear your body and get behind our head trip and what's coming out of our body. And, well, I won't go into that farther. Let's see what other.
I would be interested in hearing your ideas about the notion of how to avoid being attached to the idea that you must have true happiness.
Very good question. As I understand your question, how to avoid being attached to the idea that you must have happiness. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is When I looked at this theme and tried to really think of what true happiness is, and so many things came up for me that are not happy. And so I realized that when we think that we have to be happy, or we look at the word happiness, we have a narrow idea of what happiness is. And that's what we have to expand. I mean, can I be... After a long and very agonizing for her and the family and her husband and her high school age son, my nephew's wife died just a couple of days ago. Is there a happiness that encompasses all that that family has been through and is going through now? I think that there is a happiness like that that we are referring to as true happiness. Well, I remember reading Thich Nhat Hanh a long time ago when he was active in Vietnam, talking about his smile, which is part of his basic posture. And I can say from having spent a little bit of time with him that his smile is not a grin. It's something else. But he said, I had to be able to smile standing on the streets of a bombed out village in Vietnam the morning after a bombing raid, before the bodies had been picked up. What is that smile about? It's not a grin, I know. But there is something, I think, well, how easily a cold or upset stomach can make me unhappy. But when I fully accept the fact that life means having colds, and having colds means I'm alive. Life means death, and facing death means that I have the great privilege of being in this cycle of life-death. Does that get at your question? Yes.
Can I add to your comment? To me, the way I think about it is, if you're attached to happiness, it's also an attachment to suffering. Because if you're attached to happiness, then like the absence of that happiness is suffering. And also, like, it's part of being suffering is simply part of being human, I think. And the fact that you expect to be happy all the time, that expectation, then when you're not happy, I think it makes the suffering worse. It's like denying part of your humanity. You deny your ability to feel sad. That's part of the experience of being human. You should let the sadness come and let it go. Let the happiness come and let it go. Whatever arises, I think that's how I choose to live my life anyway.
Thank you. And Anne's comments, I think what Anne was pointing out is that it is some of the unhappiest places that are the source of a deeper acceptance. We could say a deeper kind of happiness.
I'm reminded of a line from a well-known Mary Oliver poem, Wild Geese. And the two lines that I will not quote because I don't have that good a memory, but there's one line near the beginning where she says, tell me of your despair, and I will tell you mine. And then there's the motion of the poem is eventually culminates in a line that says, and take your place in the, what is it, the family of life or something like that. So as I was listening to this conversation, I just thought there's a kind of perfume, might be one sense to touch into, but a kind of song. There's a kind of song of life that I connect to when I'm not completely absorbed in the temporary sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or even neutral. If I'm just tuned in, then that's then I feel like I'm part of the, I'm taking my place in the family of life. So that's another way to be offered to say, here's something to consider as you're considering happiness.
Thank you. What else? Carla?
I highly recommend the movie Inside Out.
Inside Out.
It's an animated film, and there are four main characters: joy, sadness, anger, and fear. And one of the main themes of the movie is that Joy doesn't want happiness to express her feelings. Because it bums her out too much. Or Joy didn't want sadness to express her feelings. So it's just a really great movie. And it brings up how we watch our minds and watch our feelings come up. So if you haven't seen it, I recommend it.
Thank you. Inside Out. Peter.
I think that I naturally have kind of a big world view, and seeing the balance in nations or in cultures and things like that. But I think through my practice, I have a bigger sense of me or mine. And I hear people talk of my feelings and I this and I'm that. And so I think that the field, if you will, or the sangha, or this, whatever's feeding my senses, I consider as me and mine. And allowing those things to come and go and enjoy them, whether they be loss and grief or joy of the bird singing in the tree, this is the field of happiness arising or sadness arising. And that I tend to be aware of when I'm saying I am this or I am, because that again separates me from the oneness. And my feelings, my happiness is a separation right away as soon as I say that, unless I have a bigger sense of me, I, and my as being the field of that which is feeding those six sense gates, and then how I interpret it and care about it or not care about it is the inner mind kind of thing. So I think on a growth path in the Buddhist way, that Buddha mind is just an expansive sense of me or I to include the big, like you opened with, I as the world, I as the, or at least what I can relate to with those.
Thank you. And I think that that's why interdependence comes up as so important, connection even with the Yogacara, in connection with this outlook. And what I'm hearing you talking about might be Kyoku Song, Thich Nhat Hanh's smile, the recognition of that vast universe that we really are, not me. Anything else? Dan.
Only very indirectly related to happiness, but thank you for emphasizing the importance of sitting in a group. I understand sitting alone, the value of it, and sometimes the necessity of it, but and I can't understand the difference, but that sitting in a group has some kind of power, some kind of connection that is essential. So thank you for that.
Good. Bob.
Ken, if all your basic needs are fulfilled, like the food, shelter, if that's all fulfilled, would you be happy?
If all my basic needs, food, shelter, medicine, clothing, were fulfilled, would I be happy? Not necessarily. No. There's too much evidence around me.
Well, but say a native there in the Amazon, he doesn't have to go out hunting every day. He has his basic needs fulfilled.
Well, I would think, we might say those basic needs, and I think the Buddha recognized those basic needs of food, shelter, clothing, what's the other one? Medicine. Need to be met, first of all. But I can't see... I don't know. I can't answer for somebody at a more primitive culture. Certainly, there would be happiness if those needs are generally not met, or I have lived in a situation where those needs are not met. I would be happier having them met. But that's a vulnerable happiness, isn't it? I could lose those next year. And I also could become so devoted to those that I begin to steal what I can from my neighbor and get into a lot of trouble.
Well, that's just it there. The more we evolve, the more we need.
Yes.
And if we go back to the very primitive society, they just have very basic needs.
And maybe what you're pointing out is that a very primitive society where your needs are very basic, you just don't develop that desire for a lot of unneeded things. You don't have that opportunity. Stu.
I'm reminded of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. He was talking about observing several members of the community in the prison camp. I'm not sure if it was Auschwitz or which one of those camps. And these people would give the last of their bread or whatever it had to someone else and just go hungry for the day. And my memory is failing me, but he made a statement something to the effect that something about no matter the circumstances in which you find yourself, you can always choose to make someone else's life better, or perhaps even through that, bringing a moment of contentment and happiness to you in that act. And when you picture that in that kind of context where there is immense suffering. You know, to have someone decide in that simple gesture to give something that is valuable to you away, that to me, I think, is the issue of being in the moment and being happy.
Well, that's the act of generosity.
Yes.
You can gain happiness from that.
Yes.
Our time is up. Do you have a quick comment?
I think a lot of happiness, this is going to sound weird, but deciding when you're going to live and what moment you're going to live in. Like, I could, like, after go to work tomorrow, I could say, oh, I'm going to hate being at work tomorrow. But when I sit here now and think about how much I'm not going to like being at work tomorrow, I'm living in a place where instead of being here right now where everything is well, I'm already putting myself in a place where I'm going to be unhappy. Or I can look at something that's happened in the past and say, oh man, I made this mistake in the past, so now I'm unhappy. But by doing that, I'm living in the past. And I'm bringing that unhappiness here right now. Does that make any sense? Or?
Thank you.
Closing chant is on.